This is God's word. Now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." So she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem, and he said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." And they answered, "The Lord bless you." Then Boaz said to his young man who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this?" And the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered, "She is the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers.' So she came, and she has continued from early morning until now, except for a short rest." Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter. Do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping, and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn." Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?" But Boaz answered her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Then she said, "I have found favor in your eyes, my lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I am not one of your servants." And at mealtime Boaz said to her, "Come here and eat some bread and dip your morsel in the wine." So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed to her roasted grain, and she ate until she was satisfied, and she had some left over. When she rose to glean, Boaz instructed his young men, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not reproach her, and also pull out some from the bundles for her, and leave it for her to glean, and do not rebuke her." So she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. And she took it up and went into the city. Her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She also brought out and gave her what food she had left over after being satisfied. And her mother-in-law said to her, "Where did you glean today? And where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, "The man's name with whom I worked today is Boaz." And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." Naomi also said to her, "The man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers." And Ruth the Moabite said, "Besides, he said to me, 'You shall keep close to my young men until they have finished all my harvest.'" And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women, lest in another field you should be assaulted." So she kept close to the young women of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvests. And she lived with her mother-in-law. May God bless the reading of his word.
Well, let's think for a moment about so-called coincidences. We hear that word, we use that word all the time. Isn't it a coincidence? Of all the coincidences, what a coincidence this is. You know, I find it interesting, though, that we use the word, but I don't actually believe that many of us actually believe in coincidences at all, especially when it actually matters. Even deeply secular people, they use language that betrays the fact that they even don't believe in coincidences. They say the universe puts us in the same place at the same time. That it was fate. That everything happens for a reason. We can debate the theology underneath language by that. Language like that. But what it reveals is that the human heart actually isn't built or made to believe that the world is governed by randomness. We sense, even when we can't name the source, that something or someone is over it all. And the Bible tells us that that something or someone is actually called providence. Providence is the truth that God, in his wisdom and power, upholds and he governs all things and all people and all events towards his plan. In plain words, it means that nothing just happens, but that God is in control. Well, in Ruth chapter 2, we see a masterclass in what providence looks like in the world today. But providence not in a burning bush, providence not in some obvious miracle, but providence in the ordinary Monday morning. When a widow goes out to glean, when a man just happens to walk out and check on the work at the precise right moment. When a little extra grain is left behind on purpose. That's it. That's kind of the whole point of this chapter. Church, our God is a God of not only sovereignty, but of providence, governing all things for the purpose of his glory and the blessing of his people. So here's the truth. Here's the vital lesson that I actually think is deeply encouraging for us today. Is that because God works all things for his people's good, most often through his people, we can trust his hand even when we cannot trace it. Hear that again. Because God works all things for his people's good, often through his people, we can trust his hand even when we cannot trace it. So, if you haven't already, turn in your Bibles to Ruth chapter 2. We're going to walk through this passage by looking at kind of what I would see is just the three movements that are within this narrative already. And the first movement is simply what I'll call providential happenings in verses 1 through 7. Providential happenings. Verse 1 says, "Now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz." So I actually find this really interesting throughout, like all narratives in Scripture, but particularly here, that the author gives us a peek behind the curtain and tells us something that the people that were in the story didn't actually know at that moment. Here within this narrative, the author is telling us, he's kind of giving like us a tip of the hand that Ruth and Naomi didn't know. He introduces us to this man named Boaz. Boaz is described as, quote, a worthy man. Essentially, that means that he's a man of real weight. He's just, he's upright, he's respected. And most importantly, if you look back at the text, he is, quote, of the clan. He's of the clan of Naomi's deceased husband. Stay tuned for why that's important. But after this brief kind of tilt of the hand, the action actually begins in verse 2. If you look back at it, it says, "Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, 'Let me go into the field, glean among the ears of the grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor. Watch for the repetition of that word favor, okay? And she, Naomi, said to her, Ruth, go, my daughter. Now, for us to understand what's happening in this text, we have to understand what is gleaning, right? That's one of the two kind of laws in this passage that you have to understand what's happening. Gleaning is essentially the process by which, in a field, a person would come after the reapers, after the harvesters, after the servants of the landowner, and the person would be able to, they would be allowed to go and glean, to pick up what was left over. And sometimes they would go on the outskirts of the field, and they would be able to go and pick up that which would help them sustain, survive, because these people, the people who would glean, would be the poorest of the poor. They would be the people who were the most vulnerable. They would be the outsiders, the sojourners, that would have no chance at kind of sustaining themselves during hard days or hard travel unless God's people actually obeyed God's law and left the things and welcomed them in to glean. This wasn't just a kind of a cultural norm, nor was this some man-made like welfare system. This was the law of God that he set out to provide for the most vulnerable in the community. This was God's plan to sustain his people and to sustain them through his people, the Israelites. That was God's plan, that God would provide for the vulnerable through the generosity and the obedience of his people. We see there in Leviticus 19, Leviticus 23, we see multiple times that God's people are ordered or commanded to observe and to provide through this gleaning process. But listen to how Deuteronomy chapter 24 describes this. It says, when you reap your harvest in the field and forget a sheaf in the field, part of the grain, you shall not go back and get it. It shall be for the sojourner, the fatherless, the widow. And then God ties it back to why they should do this. Verse 22 of Deuteronomy 24 says, you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I command you to do this. So Ruth goes out and says to Naomi, hey, we don't have anything to eat. We can't provide for ourselves, so let me go out and glean in the field. It's actually pretty obvious from this text that Naomi knew, that her going out and gleaning was a command that God gave her margin for that, but that since she was a Moabite and since she was a widow, this would have actually been a dangerous thing for her to undertake. So she's praying for the Lord's providence in this. She is requesting permission from her mother-in-law, and then she goes out with Naomi's blessing. Verse 3 says, Ruth, again, she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And here's the most beautiful part. And she, quote, happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz. She just happened. What a coincidence. Did you catch that? The narrator just did something beautiful. He uses this kind of like hyperbole within this text. And I bet he's kind of snickering as he wrote it, because he's showing us Ruth's perspective in the moment. She just happened to come to the field of Boaz. And the author's kind of like winking at us and being like, well, we know it's a little bit more than just happening within this text, do we not? We know it because he already introduced us to Boaz previously, told us that it was of the family, the clan, and we know it because of the rest of the book that this was anything but coincidence, a mere happening. God obviously orchestrated this, even though Ruth had no clue. My friends, the same is true in our lives. Over and over and over, even you being here today. One of my favorite Puritan writers, pastors, John Flavel, said it well when he writes that providence, like Hebrew, must be read backwards. The Hebrew language, you read it from right to left. If you try to read it from left to right, it literally makes no sense at all. And he writes that God's providence, if you're in it and you're trying to just move forward and read it from left to right, it's not going to make any sense. It's just weird letters. But it's only after you get through it and are able to look back and read it from then right to left that the sentences that God was writing the entire time begin to come together. You can't read it when you're in it, but you can read it from the outside, and you can read it from past the events. That's true in Ruth too, and friend, it's true in your life as well. The vast majority of times, it feels like our lives are just a series of random happenings. But there's no such things as happenings or coincidences when we have a sovereign and a providential God who relates to his people in real time and real space. God is working even when we do not recognize that he is. Even when we cannot trace his hand, he is at work. Even now. So Christian, I would just say to you, like, hold on. We can't put all the pieces together when we're in it. We don't know the full story while we're in it. And frankly, we may not ever know the full story. We may not ever be able to say the why. But that doesn't mean that God hasn't been at work. That he's not at work, literally, right now. Our God is always working. For his glory, for our good, he's working his plan according to his purposes. And friend, that is actually good news for you and for me. Ruth, in her perception, happens upon the field, but look at what happens next. I love that kind of first word of verse 4. Well, behold! It's like, oh, what a coincidence! And Shazam! Here's Boaz! Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to his reapers, "The Lord be with you." They answered, "The Lord bless you." So not only does she happen upon the field of Boaz, she happens upon the field of Boaz as Boaz happened to be coming by to check on the work in his field. He says a blessing upon his workers, didn't necessarily believe in a whole lot of division between work and the church, the secular and the sacred. His faithfulness, though, doesn't stop with like kind of this rehearsed language. He says in verse 5, Boaz said to his young reaper, you could say the foreman of the field, he looks out and he's like, who's that? Whose young woman is this? The servant said, well, she actually is this woman. She came back with Naomi, and she came here in the morning, and she's been working the entire day. She took a brief breath at one particular moment, but she's been breaking her back, laboring hard. Picture in the heat of midday, back bent, hands raw, hauling grain, barely stopping to breathe. And I would just say, like, don't rush past the fact that she's working this hard. This is a woman at the very bottom who is desperate. She's a widow. She's a foreigner. She has no husband, no land, no safety net. And she gets up in her desperate moment and goes to work. She doesn't sit in self-pity. She doesn't get bitter and blame everyone else around her. She doesn't wait for circumstances to fix themselves. She gets up and puts her hand to the proverbial plow. And I point this out to say that, like, friends, at some point in time, you're going to hit rock bottom. What are you going to do when you hit rock bottom? Are you going to sit around griping about everyone and everything in your circumstances? Or are you going to get up and go to work? Well, friend, we can just sit and lick our wounds. But friends, God often provides for his people, not on the couch, but in the field as we're working. And so friends, get up, even in the midst of hardship, even when things are very difficult and we can't see a way out, get up and be faithful. Work hard. Because this is the way that God often, most often, actually provides and sustains his people. So it's through that hard work, and it's through Boaz's inquiry, that actually leads us into the second movement of the text, where we see that through Boaz, grace goes beyond the law. Okay? That's that second movement, that grace goes beyond the law through Boaz. That's found in verses 8 through 17. Boaz speaks to his foreman, and then he actually goes out and speaks to Ruth himself, which that would have been very, very rare due to the position, the power dynamic, if you will, within this text. But in verse 8, it says, "Then Boaz said to Ruth, 'Now listen, my daughter, do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping. Go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn.'" Now, I read that and I'm like, that just seems like he's being nice and he's obeying a law that God gave. But actually, this is remarkable when we know the context of this. When Ruth committed herself to God and to caring for Naomi, she was choosing a life of perpetual widowhood, of poverty, of shame. Not just because she was a widow, but specifically because she was a Moabite widow. She didn't have any prospects or hope because of who she was and her lineage. But now she has the owner, like an older, wealthy gentleman approaching her. She may have been able to hope for kind of like an unharassed gleaning, but she could never have even dreamed up that this sort of grace would be shown to her. She wasn't expecting it. She had nothing to offer for it. But Boaz here goes far above and beyond the requirements of the law to bless this woman. Stay. Glean. Eat. Return. I will protect and provide. Look at how Ruth responds. You can tell how amazing what he just did was. It says she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found what? Favor. Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me since I'm a foreigner?" Favor. We'll see it again, but that's the same word from verse 2. The narrator is using it on purpose to show us that Boaz is Ruth's answer to prayer from verse 2. Boaz isn't just a good guy. He's the one who looks on her with favor. God is answering her prayer through Boaz. Ruth knows that she doesn't kind of like deserve to be treated well. Again, like she says, I'm a foreigner. She's a nobody. She doesn't have anything to offer. She's outside of at least the apparent people of God in Israel. Why would this man treat her in this way? Verse 11 says, Boaz answered her, "All that you've done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been told to me. How you left everything and came to a place and a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." That's why we know that Ruth didn't just like choose loyalty to Naomi, but that she actually trusted in the God of Israel, because it's under his wings that she has come to take refuge. Boaz tells her that her reputation has preceded her, that her commitment to Yahweh, her submission to him, and her commitment to her mother-in-law is known throughout the land. And then he provides for her, and he shows kindness to her, and he prays this prayer of blessing over her. Don't rush past what he prays. You see it. "Under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Now, if you know your Old Testament, that actually, like, that's not some, like, weird image. That's actually the language that the Psalms use over and over and over. That's the language that King David uses of trusting in the Lord, of submitting to him, of in faith going to the Lord for protection and security. So Boaz is essentially using the worship language of the Old Testament as a testimony and as a prayer for this foreign widow. Boaz is praying his worship language that the God of Israel would shelter this vulnerable widow under his wings. But here's the thing that I found staggering all week, okay? It's central to the main point of this chapter and in the entire book. What does Boaz do after he prays this prayer of blessing over this woman? I mean, if you look back, what does he do? He doesn't just say nice words, commend her, and then send her on her way. He doesn't pray this prayer or say these nice words and then pray that God would send somebody else to come and show grace and favor to her. No, he prays that God would bless her, and then he acts to be the means by which God blesses her. You see that in the text? Christian, have you ever considered the fact that you may be your own answer to prayer? Are there things in your life that you have prayed for, events in your life, people that you've prayed for, that it's good and right that you should present your request to God, right? He's the one that will ultimately bless and provide. But how do you know he's not intending to bless and provide for them through you? Friend, if you've been praying for someone or something for a long time, there are a whole slew of things that we cannot affect. I can't heal somebody. I can't save somebody. But guess what? I can go and try to bless somebody who's in pain. I can go and actually speak the gospel. If I need a different job, I can and should pray about it. But I should also get up and apply for jobs. Friends, God has given us this calling to be a people who pray and trust in the Lord and also get up off the couch and go to work. And friend, that's a beautiful example of what we see here within this text about what Boaz does. Look at how Ruth responds again to Boaz's kindness in prayer. Verse 13 says, "Then she said, I have found what? I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord. For you have comforted me. You've not only provided, but you've comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant. Though I'm actually not one of your servants. Basically, you don't owe it to me." As I read this, I think about the theological connections that we can see in that statement. That Boaz owed nothing to Ruth. She wasn't one of his people. And yet he went out of his way to go beyond the law, to go beyond what she deserved, and to bless her. It reminds me of what Jesus Christ has done for us. There's this, not a full-blown picture, but there's this sweet scent of Jesus in this text. Of the Jesus who we weren't his people because of our sin, because of our separation. We actually weren't even a people. But then he, in his kindness and his provision, chooses a people who are not his people, and he makes us, through his own kind sacrifice, he makes us into his people. He treats us as if we've been faithful all along, as if we've been his servants all along, but he chooses to draw us into his inner circle, not because we had anything to offer him. She's got nothing to offer him because she has nothing. And yet Boaz continues to pour out blessing upon blessing. And I praise God that we have a God who does this like a billion times more than Boaz does it in this text. Boaz voluntarily claimed Ruth, treated Ruth as his own, and God voluntarily claims us as his own, and then he pays the ultimate price to not just claim us, but to make us his people. Thanks be to God. Verse 14 continues and says, "And at mealtime, Boaz said to her, 'Come here, eat some of the bread and dip your morsel in the wine.' So she sat beside the reapers and he passed her roasted grain. She ate until she was satisfied." I'm speculating, but this was probably the first time since her husband's death that she ate until she was satisfied. And then she had some left over. "When she rose to glean, Boaz instructed his young men, saying, 'Let her glean even among the sheaves. Do not reproach her. And also, pull out some of the bundles for her. Leave it to her to glean. Do not rebuke her.'" This would have been shocking to the first readers and the people who were living this. Watch how far past Boaz keeps going in his grace and kindness to this foreign widow. The law required landowners to leave the edges of the field. Boaz assigns Ruth a place within his own young women and tells her to stay in perpetuity. The law says nothing about her safety, but Boaz, from the very start, promises her safety by commanding his servants to treat her with respect. The law said nothing about hospitality, but Boaz hands her water drawn by his own men and then seats her at a table, a place of honor, and feeds her till she's full. The law requires nothing about sabotaging your own harvest, but Boaz orders his men to pull out grain from their bundles on purpose and leave it for her. All voluntary, right? All of it extravagant. He's not kind of grossly working a scene. He's showing kindness. That's what grace looks like. That's what God has done with you and me, time and time and time again. So in verse 17, we see that Ruth works diligently from early to evening, and in the end, she has what's called an ephah of barley, somewhere around 30 to 40 pounds. Most commentators say that this would have been like a week's worth of grain for a normal gleaner. And then she bundles it up, she hauls it on her back, and she heads back home. She's got all the grain. She's got a doggy bag with her lunch leftovers. Ruth heads home in the third movement of the text, where within this third movement, we actually see Naomi begin to connect the dots of God's grace and providence. We see Naomi connect the dots in verses 18 through 23. Verse 18 begins, "She took it up and went into the city. Her mother-in-law, Naomi, saw what she had gleaned. She assumed that she had murdered someone to get all of this. She also Ruth brought out, gave her the doggy bag and said, 'Listen, I've eaten more than what I need to eat, and here's what's left over.' Her mother-in-law said to her, 'Where did you glean today? Where have you worked? Blessed is the man who took notice of you.'" Can I just, for people that were likely starving up to this point, the fact that she comes home with a week's worth after one day, it's amazing. So Ruth tells her mother-in-law with whom she worked, "The man's name with whom I worked is Boaz." Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by the Lord." Now, make sure to notice who this statement is about. The Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. Not Boaz's. Boaz's kindness is amazing. But Naomi's talking about the Lord here. "May he be blessed by the Lord. The Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." Can just pause for a second. I know it's been a long time since the first week. But this is the very same woman who in chapter 1 said, "Don't call me Naomi, call me Mara. I'm bitter because the Lord has gone out against me. He clearly doesn't love me. He clearly doesn't care about me. He clearly isn't providing for me." But now she's like, the Lord has shown grace and favor and kindness to the living and to the dead. God is at work. That's the only way we can understand what just happened on this day. She says it's the Lord's kindness who has done that. You see that her interpretation isn't, okay, I'm going to think positively about this. I'm going to practice positive self-talk. No, she sees that the Lord is the one who's responsible for this grace. And friend, we need to pray often that we will be able to see the Lord's kindness in our lives, especially when we're in dark days, especially when our hearts are prone to like labor with bitterness. We cannot conjure up seeing God on our own, except for in these like massive moments. But we can go to the Lord and ask him, like, God, show me how you're at work. Show me the glimpses of your grace in my life. And friend, you're going to see him. The Lord is at work, even in the hardship, even in the struggle of day-to-day life. She thanks the Lord for his kindness. This is that same word that we looked at last week. It's not some generic social kindness. It's true covenant loyal love. It's what Ruth and Orpah showed to Naomi. It's what Naomi prays would come upon Ruth and Orpah. And it's what Boaz lavishes upon Ruth and now consequently to Naomi. But behind all of that human hesed is the kindness of the Lord upon his people. And then she says something that is just miraculous. She says, verse 20, Naomi also said to her, the man is a close relative of ours, one of our, quote, redeemers. Now, why we're just hearing about this, why apparently Ruth is just hearing about this, we don't know. I mean, I would imagine that it was because Naomi didn't even consider that particularly important. That she didn't have hope that this would be what was happening. But then when she sees God's hand, she's like, dude, he's actually a close relative of ours. He's one that God could be providing for our rescue. That mention of one of the redeemers, our heart skips a beat. It's like that part in a movie where this huge breakthrough happens and you hope upon hope that what could possibly happen actually does come to pass. And it isn't. Naomi is basically saying there may actually be hope. Maybe it isn't only bitterness for us. We have a redeemer. And that word redeemer is more fully translated as a kinsman redeemer. That's that second like Old Testament law that we've got to understand to understand this text and the entire rest of the book. In the Old Testament, a kinsman redeemer was a relative who carried both the legal right and the covenant responsibility to buy back what a family had lost or couldn't recover on their own. Land that sold off in a hard year, a relative that sold themselves off into slavery, even the family name if a man died without an heir. This shows up multiple times in the Mosaic Law. You can read about it. Maybe you remember it from Leviticus 25. All two of you who would remember that. But friends, whenever we have this mention of kinsman redeemer, like I hope and pray that your heart immediately goes and like places it side by side with the gospel in the New Testament. Okay? There's lots of passages that would make this connection for us. But what we see is that we are like these people who have sold ourselves over to slavery. We are people who have nothing good to offer, who have nothing that we could buy back our own freedom or our own value. We have nothing that we could provide for ourselves. And yet it's into that moment that Jesus Christ becomes our kinsman redeemer. We, like Ruth and Naomi, were completely dependent upon the gracious intervention, the gracious intervening provision of someone outside of us to rescue us, to redeem us. That's exactly what God himself became in Jesus. Christ took on flesh that he might be able to be a redeemer on our behalf. He took on flesh so that he could be like us, our substitute. He could pay our price. He's fully man, and yet he's fully God. His sacrifice is actually able to cover the sins of all those who would trust in him for salvation.